That'll do, if you'll stop.
Pablo, I want to ask you a question. In your talk, you said in relationship to the Anthropocene that there was, the Anthropocene was a crisis of scientific knowledge. And I would like you to explain what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as the way that we have been making reflection with indigenous people is that the crisis situation that the whole planet is living right now, it's difficult to get with that thinking and say to indigenous people, hey, this problem is the result of all of us as a human being. So when indigenous people say, hey, but we don't think, we never have think like you. No? And it's your way to understand who took us to this stage, you know? And that's why I said that the scientific knowledge and the Anthropocene is showing the limit, is showing that we don't know enough. And probably we're not able to know enough to get a solution. So we need new understanding.
That's an interesting point you put together, because when you think of science and the movement forward for science and this idea of it being human-centric, the way science is working is towards humans finding solutions for what they've actually, not all humans, of course, for what they've actually created in the first place, and also science working from a single only, I will solve this solution versus a collective of human and more than human others, and in particular, other ways of thinking and being. So that is an interesting thing to talk about. Oh, Kelly from Canada.
Yeah, I was going to say, interjections are welcome if you say who you are.
So can I just just going to say something else that we were able to learn so far from Ritchie people is that cosmovision, that way of being and living, and particularly if you're watching the projects that the young people did in the Wikimedia school when they went back to community, are just so full of, I don't even like using the word solution, but, you know, possibilities for thinking about reclamation of land and place. And I just don't think that's visible yet, that young people, particularly indigenous young people, Canada and Vanuatu, who you'll hear about tomorrow and all over, are already doing this work. And as Debbie was saying, they're just silenced and marginal anyway. And so some of the fear of our treading is that you don't want to appropriate this, and what is the way in which we can have those open, indigenous, non-indigenous, human, non-human conversations in some way where we can get to this common world and this common ground that I'd like to have problems talking about.
Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter from Birmingham in the UK. So I want to ask James and Maeve about the strike movements. Because one of the things I've been talking about with colleagues at Birmingham and elsewhere is how, certainly in the UK, they are predominantly white spaces. And you made a connection very briefly with some kind of critical race activists in Australia. I just wondered if you could say more about those relationships and to what extent the movement in Australia has also been predominantly white.
Yeah, it has been predominantly white in Australia too, I think, but we didn't really have time to touch on it. There are some young Indigenous activists that are part of the movement too. But yeah, I think if we sort of build on this work, I think that's something that we will definitely have to incorporate into our paper and definitely make mention of that.
A couple of key sort of ideas around the Jabwarong trees. There's a highway being built just outside of Melbourne that's been redirected to save 3 minutes of travel time, and that's designed to knock down number of 100 sacred trees, birthing trees, and there's many young people who are of Indigenous Australian Aboriginal background, and I'd like to investigate that more and think about that more. But we didn't want to just touch on something, really. We want to spend a lot of time thinking about that and the droughts in the Murray-Darling Basin and the young people who are involved in the problems on their country as well. So yeah. It's definitely important, but we just didn't focus on it.
Mindy from Perth in Australia. I'm wondering, to add on to that, if you've maybe one of the ways to make connections with what's going on in Australia with the climate strike action could be around the Seed Mob group. So are you familiar with them? So that would be an Aboriginal group that started probably 5 years ago in Melbourne, and it's been growing momentum. So I'm curious if they've linked up. So that
could
be interesting.
Yeah.
They have. They definitely have. Okay. So a friend of my daughter's, who's involved pretty heavily in the climate strike activism, went recently to Melbourne, and they had like an intersectional meet and skill share.
Gosh, there's so much we can learn from the other people.
Yeah.
We certainly aren't doing that.
And the comment there is that I think what we see is emergence. You know, so at the moment it might look very white, possibly even very middle class in some contexts. But I think, you know, the nature of emergence, particularly when people start having conversations across spaces that were spaces of division before rather than spaces of possibility, I think that's the, for me anyway, in terms of seeing some of the things that are happening in this space. Is that possibility, that sense of possibility is there in ways that quite possibly it wasn't before.
We talk about generations in our subgroup. this lady from Sweden, Thornberry, is saying that this is a generational movement, this climate. Have we global generations nowadays? Are they different ones if we are comparing them to the big generational conflict between the 60s and older generations? They were a conflict. But now as Thornberry is saying that you have to take, old guys, you have to take your role. This is not conventional contradiction. Or my question is that have we global generations? Is this global movement? And is it the generation movement? Because I have contradictory facts. And
anybody want to comment on that? Because I think that's, in youth studies, a really interesting challenge, because generation is such a fundamental concept in youth studies and people like
in
Dan
Mannheim
Woodman.
Sense,
Dan Woodman and Joanna Wynne have been writing about generations and kicked off discussions about generation, not unproblematically. So is generation one of those concepts in this context that we need to fundamentally rethink and try to understand the usefulness of that as a concept in youth studies?
I think in the school strike for climate, though, that some of the young people have been sort of admonishing what they're saying, that old generations have failed us and they've, you know, broken the planet. That's quite divisive. I'm not sure that, it's a good way to kind of capture people's attention, but as a sort of like way to build solidarity, I don't think it's a really good strategy.
I was at the Melbourne school, the first school climate strike, and there's a huge crowd out front of the Treasury building in central Melbourne, and one of the signs was, old men don't understand climate change. I think they are fundamentally playing with the concept of generation in the way in which they organise, and is that a problem, is that an issue, yeah. What does it do? Mm-hmm.
I'm Nicola from Brunel University of London. Who asked the question, but it was about, you know, is the global, you made the point about, is it a global generational thing? And I do research in Southern Africa, where actually generation has always been politicized. It's always been the youth against the older generation, and it's most countries in Africa tend to be quite gerontocratic in their political structures, and then youth actually is something that comes to inhabit anybody under the age of 40, claims to be a youth and to have a... But I was really struck by the presentation, it was Lucas
and Ross.
Ross, presenting about young people in universities in Australia, France, UK, because so much of that resonated with my research with primary school children in Africa, in Lesotho, at a certain level, because I think there is a sort of awareness of growing up in a changing world and uncertainty, that real uncertainty absolutely permeates young people's perspectives on the future. I think in a way that it probably didn't 20 years ago, where there were secure jobs in mining or whatever. But it's tacit. It's not, they don't reflect upon it. And although the school curriculum is trying to encourage, I mean, they've got a subject area of creativity and entrepreneurship, where the curriculum is telling them, you need to be flexible, you need to, all these things that, you know, cut that, sort of, that your students were talking about. But they don't really get that. They don't get it when it comes from school. School is about a lot of books later, but school is about going and getting your security, getting your secure job, getting your formal sector job. But at the same time, they have this sort of tacit understanding that life's not going to be like that, that life is going to be about uncertainty. And you ask them, what can you do when you're sort of waiting to get a permanent job? And they will come up with hundreds of ideas of things that they might do. And some of them will be like within the locality, some will be involved migration, whatever, but they're not expecting. It's not quite the same, but there's a sort of real striking similarity there.
Very, very similar. I mean, you know, because we were interviewing young university students, it was very much in an institutional context. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the book, you know, out of which this incredibly brief presentation came, you know, talked a lot about the discourses and the promises that higher education as a system makes to young people. And there's a very strong discourse, and you can map it out in the public language and the policy documents of the universities that we chose, but probably, you know, most others as well. And the promise is a very old-fashioned promise. It is about secure pathways. It is about, it has these sort of globalized, mobile overtones, you know, an education from our university will enable you to take your place in the world, you know, as a mobile actor, but it's a very classed, it's a very, you know, it's about being an economic, social, mobile, superior actor, not just an actor, but someone who can, you know, take a prominent position, a leading position in the world, blah, blah, blah. So part of our question to our young interviewees was, what does that promise look like for you? What is that, does that mean anything to you? How does that relate to your own imagined futures? And again, I mean, we really, you know, we found a very, very similar kind of pattern. They speak to that promise very clearly. I'm doing this degree, many of them were postgrads, I'm doing my master's degree because I've been told that, or I hope that, or my parents hope that, or because there's this possibility of blah, 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 work security, you know, prosperity. But then when we talked about their actual personal plans, it was like, well, I might look at moving to Australia. I think there might be something in Germany. I've always been really, well, I'm not sure. Well, you know, so again, these kind of dual discourses all the way through.
So if there's I was just going to go to the Chilean situation in your presentation and the ways in which some young people spoke against that. They talked about a market-based education and that's what the education system is about, but they were looking for more and they were wanting to engage in more. So can you make a comment in that?
Well, I guess that was my question I was asking. Did you see anything, are they angry yet that the university is aligned to them? You know, is there any way in which, you know, this connection, obviously, between what they're being sold, probably at a high price too in Australia, like everywhere else, is a lie? And or did you go there in your interviews? I mean, I guess the stories that Pablo and Deb were showing, they do say, if you just give an open space to young people about, well, how's this going? Yeah, it's a lie. You know, we see that education is actually not for humanity or our rights or something and the system. So I was just wondering if there was any of that in what you were seeing.
Yeah, and again, I mean, that was, because we were also talking about, we seem to be talking about everything, we were also talking about post-truth, you know, living in, being a young person in post-truth times. And part of the post-truth idea, we linked back to those discourses and promises of higher education. So in a way, one of our questions was, the promise that higher education will buy you security, is that a post-truth promise? You know, an empty rhetoric, blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, so they recognised, in a sense, the fallacy or the emptiness of the promise, but I would say that they were still investing a lot of hope into it. I don't think, I mean, I was really struck by, you know, the observations by the young people in your Chilean project. And, I mean, I don't feel that we got anything quite as, critical as that.
If getting a degree or a qualification is a currency of opportunity, there doesn't appear to be any other currency through which they can exchange value, which means that you can recognise that it's, you're going to need higher and higher qualifications, but they're only dealing a certain kind of currency. So the idea is it's what credential inflation is. You just keep dealing and upping and upping and upping the currency, knowing full well that each time you go to it, it's got less value economically. And that is definitely, they knew that, they knew what the game was, but they hadn't called it out yet.
Yeah, there's some way in which, at least in Canada, the managers of universities, the administrators now, have purchased the kids on their side. You know, they're quite swimming pools and, you know, nice places to hang out and student centres and experience centres and all of that. So that might dampen, you know, because they're your friends, those administrators, and they wouldn't lie. It's a guess. I'm just wondering if there's something like that going on.
Yes, one comment that really struck me thinking about the professional discourse of, you know, being an educator in a UK institution. I'm thinking about as a social worker in practice, when you have young people who are approaching adulthood, you have to think very carefully about ensuring their pathway into adulthood is legally secured, and this idea that you're touching on, that going to university in order to provide you the certainty of a job, being completely undermined, but that is in fact the measurement, one of the measurements that we look at, positive outcomes for young people once they reach that level and get into employment after university, which is, you know, by your discussion, completely undermined.
So, Pablo, do you want to make a comment about the Chilean